Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover.
I mean, I was told point blank by someone who works for him that if it makes him look good, the president will be unhappy because the president is very much aware of what's going on all the time. And he's, you know, he doesn't want to be overshadowed by his vice president. And that's often the case, but it's exaggerated now.
Today's guest, Kate Anderson Brower, author of the new book, First in Line. Kate's book is a look at vice presidents and their relationships going back to Eisenhower and Nixon. But with so much attention these days to the current vice president, Mike Pence, and the last vice president, Joe Biden, this was a great way of digging in on them, getting more of a sense of who each of them are, who Presidents Trump and President Obama are, and what the future might hold for everyone involved. What if, say, there's a Pence versus Biden presidential election coming? Well, we discussed all of that. Remember to subscribe, rate us, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or however you're listening. Email me your thoughts at isaac@politico.com and follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover. You've got so much more great stuff coming. And now, my conversation with Kate Anderson Brower. So the other day, Donald Trump Jr. tweeted a photo of Mount Rushmore, and he circled a spot, and he said something like, "We're waiting for President Trump." I wonder, what is your sense of how President Trump sees himself within the history of presidents, within that club, and how he relates to them?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think that he clearly sees himself apart from them, and he often tweets very critically of his predecessors, which is unprecedented. Usually you know,
and not just Obama, others too.
Yeah, Bush. And I mean, there's some deference to the people who came before you. And I think he sees himself as more like Ronald Reagan. I don't think we hear him criticize Reagan very much. Mm-hmm. And so he sees himself as someone who's broken the mold like Reagan did. And a lot of people who work for him have told me that he thinks of himself like Ronald Reagan. But when I interviewed Nancy Reagan, she indicated that they are nothing alike. So,
and when did that conversation with Nancy Reagan happen?
That happened in my book, The Residence.
Right. So Trump
a long
is,
time ago.
Right. But she already knew who Donald Trump was.
Yeah, she knew who he was. I mean, this was actually this was during 2016.
So she's already seeing him as a presidential.
Yes.
Candidate.
Yeah. This is when he went to the Reagan Library. Mm-hmm. Did the debate there. But Nancy Reagan was someone who didn't like any Republicans comparing themselves to her husband, right?
Right. she guarded that very.
Yeah, no one was as wonderful as Ronald Reagan.
But I do think Steve Bannon made the comparisons to Andrew Jackson for Donald Trump. He has that picture of Andrew Jackson that he put in the Oval Office. He sometimes will talk about Lincoln and say, sort of famously last year said, "Oh, a lot of people don't know, but he was a Republican." Trump is not someone who is steeped in the history of this stuff. And in some ways, it's a direct counterpoint to the much more professorial approach that Obama took. Mm-hmm. I remember I did a story about this when Obama was president, that he used to have regular seminars of presidential historians mm-hmm. come to the White House and talk with him about his place in history, and he was obsessed with it and obsessed with fitting in that way. It's a very different approach, and Trump is it, which is the break of the mold, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I interviewed some of those historians when I was a reporter at Bloomberg, like, oh gosh, H.W. Brands, I think, was mm-hmm. one of them, and Doris Kearns Goodwin was one of them, about what those conversations were like with Obama. And I think it was just he was genuinely very interested in history. And like you said, the complete opposite of Donald Trump, who doesn't seem to know that much about his predecessors, except for these flashpoints that he can use in arguments against them. Like, I was surprised at how tough he was on the Bush administration and the Iraq War. I think there's always a sense for Republicans to be looking back at their predecessors and or a Democrat. I mean, you can't imagine Barack Obama being outwardly critical of Bill Clinton, even though privately I did some reporting that showed that he and Michelle Obama thought that what Clinton did to degrade the presidency mm-hmm. was a terrible thing. But he would never outwardly have criticized Clinton for Monica Lewinsky or any of that. And so it's amazing how Donald Trump has changed the presidency and the way that presidents communicate with people. I mean, it's incredible.
But I also think Obama seemed in some ways constrained by trying to think of himself in history all the time. And part of what Trump part of what powers him is not thinking about that, right? Yeah. People say, criticize him, he always thinks in the moment, but he I don't think that he spends a lot of time thinking about what his presidential library is going to look like and how they exist. But whereas like Obama was always in that space a little bit.
And he's very zen. I mean, there's been reporting that he's really zen about Donald Trump and that he doesn't.
I'm not sure that's entirely where things are, but.
That he just doesn't like that Michelle Obama cares a lot more about it, but that he actually doesn't allow himself to get so wound up and caught up in it. And I can see that he was very cerebral and and at peace. And not really someone, when I interviewed Joe Biden, he said, you know, I had to get him to listen to his gut all the time. And Obama had trouble doing that and being emotional.
Biden famously said something like, he would tell people, I've never seen somebody who's better at speaking to 10,000 people than to one.
Right.
That was, the that was Biden's assessment of Obama.
Yeah.
Your book, you say it's over 200 people that you talk to for it. How do you go about figuring out who the right people to talk to are and then getting them to participate in this? You talk to all the living vice presidents, right? Did you talk to Pence in the end?
No.
He did not, right? Because you had an interview and then he canceled it.
Yes. So twice, once I was actually, my social security number was, you know, cleared in because to get into the White House, you have to get that far. And so it was confirmed, but this was during Hurricane Harvey and he came back and there were all these headlines. I think there was a Politico headline at the time saying that, you know, he, Pence overshadowed Trump and was just able to connect with people in a way Trump couldn't. And I think that, you know, Nick Ayers, who's Pence's chief of staff, is very protective, very smart, and understands that, you know, there's no upside for Pence to talk about his position unless it's to get a specific message out, which he will do. But he doesn't agree to talk to reporters often and not to authors. It's really tricky because people feel like they can't control that message. And it's always harder, I think, for a book to get an interview. Although I was surprised how easy it was to talk to Dick Cheney, for instance. I thought that would be really hard, but I think he really appreciates history. He wanted to talk about Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon. Al Gore was hard to get an interview with because those days were hard to for him, the 2000 election. He lost.
He doesn't do many interviews.
No.
We've actually tried to get him on the podcast.
Oh, you have? Talk about climate change.
That was part of the pitch.
Okay. Yeah, he's really tricky. He's really tricky.
But so you think that for Pence it was there's no upside because he thinks the president will see this and not like it?
Yes. I mean, I was told point blank by someone who works for him that if it makes him look good, the president will be unhappy because the president is very much aware of what's going on all the time. And he's, you know, he doesn't want to be overshadowed by his vice president. And that's often the case, but it's exaggerated now. It's like, it does remind me of Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey, because Johnson wouldn't let Humphrey, you know, take press on his plane. And he just didn't want him to get any attention. If there were leaks, he always criticized Humphrey for it. And it was just this kind of icky relationship between the two of them when it's not close. And I think that Pence is very deferential to the point of a Hubert Humphrey almost.
You, at the end of your chapter on the Pence-Trump relationship, you write, Pence must be exhausted.
Yeah. I'm exhausted just thinking about what his life is like, right?
But why do you think that is? Why must he be exhausted?
Because he can't do anything without overthinking and trying to understand what his boss is going to do. And he's so mercurial. Who knows? We don't know what Donald Trump is going to do day to day. And I can't imagine what it's like working for him. Like I was told that when he went on this one of his first foreign trips, he
when Pence went on.
Yes. Yeah. And he called Donald Trump and it was 1 a.m. where he was in Europe. And he called Trump to go over the speech line by line. And that's the kind of thing that it had already been vetted by the West Wing. But he felt the need to also go through.
Right. That's usually something that a vice president's staff would handle with the president's staff, and there wouldn't even be a conversation with the vice president and the president about it. But Pence felt that he needed to get Trump himself on the phone and talk about this.
Yeah. And there was no kind of shame in it when his staff told me that. You know, it was just like, this is how much he cares about getting it right. And he's kind of a translator for Trump, too. Mm-hmm. You know, he'll.
Right. This was a speech that he gave in Europe.
Yeah.
That was basically saying to people, don't worry too much about all that anti-NATO rhetoric. Right. It's not going to be that way.
Yep.
That was a year and change ago. And that was before we saw what happened in the G7 last month and how things are going. But in that was seen as a very important speech and an important moment for Pence, an important moment for the presidency.
Absolutely. And I think that he does kind of bring down the temperature. And I interviewed a donor, a very wealthy Republican donor, who said without Pence, it would be even more caustic than it is now. And mm-hmm. that he is that voice who's whispering in the president's ear. He can get the president's attention. This was since I wrote the book, but I talked to someone who worked on the National Security Council, and he said he was in the Oval Office and Trump was on the phone and he was trying to get his attention. And he went to Pence, and Pence was able to get his attention. So it's not that they have a terrible relationship. They do spend a lot of time together. It's just that Mike Pence is always deferential, agreeing with him, very rarely disagreeing. And I think a little fear is mixed in there.
A little fear on Pence's part mm-hmm. of Trump. Well, Trump makes fun of him. That's one of the things in the book, right? He makes fun of him being religious.
Yeah. Someone told me they wouldn't be surprised if his nickname was the Deacon, but I could never get that confirmed.
But you do have in there that Trump sometimes says to people who come into the White House, oh, did Mike pray for you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're fascinated. I think the Trumps are fascinated by the Pences because there was a meeting between them at Bedminster before Pence was announced. Mm-hmm. And, you know, someone described to me who was there that like they sat and were the Pences said to the Trumps, Melania and Donald Trump, you know, we've been praying for you. Mm-hmm. And the Trumps were like, what are you talking about?
I've heard that story myself. Yeah. And that then it kind of hit Trump and he took it a little bit more seriously, or at least was taking it seriously for the conversations with Pence that would go forward from there. And that there was a moment ahead of the vice presidential debate, the last time that Trump and Pence spoke, that Trump said to him, hey, Mike, I'm praying for you.
Yeah.
And Pence was like, maybe that's sincere, actually. But it does seem like that is not where Trump is on that on the question of praying in the time since, which I think is interesting given how much he talks about religious freedom and that this the importance of Christianity and saying Merry mm-hmm. Christmas and all those things and the relationship that he's developed with evangelicals who are such an important part of it. He goes to church not every Sunday at all, but Easter, Christmas, he's mm-hmm. gone. And yet we, from your reporting, I think from other reporting as well, we see that he doesn't take it so much inside of himself. I think your reporting is interesting in that he's making fun of Mike Pence essentially for being religious.
Yeah. I mean, I think to an extent this is all just, you know, Donald Trump is using religion to solidify the base and Mike Pence is his greatest tool and he might not have won. I mean, there was that weekend with the Access Hollywood mm-hmm. tape where Pence, you know, Trump had to call and apologize to Pence. And I interviewed people in Indiana and friends of Pence and his brother Greg. And, you know, they said that Pence would never have obviously said anything like what Trump said on that tape, but that Karen Pence was particularly like upset by it. Donald Trump had to apologize to her personally. But they get very kind of – they talk about it in hushed tones, the Indiana mm-hmm. friends, because I think that they get that it was the one time where Pence really had control mm-hmm. in that relationship. And if he had wanted to drop out, Donald Trump might not be president. And
he would have probably been applauded by at least some parts of the Republican Party for doing that at that point. That was a point where we know Reince Priebus, who then, of mm-hmm. course, was the Republican chairman and went on to be the first chief of staff, told Trump that he thought he should drop out also. Right?
Yeah. It's hard to think back to that when like no one thought that he would win.
Right. Of course, since 3 weeks before the election, whenever it was. And there is also that transformation of Pence, that the way that he subsumed himself to Trump, I think strikes a lot of people all the time around the travel ban decision. That's one of the places now where it came back up that Pence said, and there's even a tweet from his governor account that said that banning a Muslim ban would be immoral and unconstitutional. And now he's part of an administration that is proudly celebrating the fact that this travel ban was upheld by the Supreme Court. So what is that with Mike Pence? I know you didn't get to talk to him about it, but is it just the chain of command? Mm-hmm. How does he get through that difference, that stark difference? Every vice president has to give up some things. Mm-hmm. With George H.W. Bush, right, he had to tell Ronald Reagan that he would not stop saying voodoo economics, mm-hmm. and that he would change his position on abortion, right? Mm-hmm. But so it's not the first time that a vice president has done this. But this seems like a pretty extreme switch.
I mean, they call him On Message Mike for a reason. You know, he is, and he talks about servant leadership, which to him is, you know, the code of his entire job is dependent on this one person, mm-hmm. the president. And he's deeply ambitious and has wanted to be president since he was in high school. So the close, I mean, he could have lost mm-hmm. his race in Indiana when he was running. And so this is an incredible moment for him where he knows there's a huge chunk of most Republicans and a huge portion of the country who really like Donald Trump and really like how he's mm-hmm. shaking things up. So for Mike Pence, this is really it would be silly for him to do anything mm-hmm. but what he's doing, which is really he is somebody who follows the chain of command. And when I asked a Pence staffer for a good example of how Pence sees his relationship with Trump, they referred me to this commencement address mm-hmm. in Annapolis where he clearly outlines, you know, always follow your superiors without question. Do not question. Just do what you're told.
Another thing you pick up in the book of this tradition of presidents and vice presidents having lunch. Usually it's once mm-hmm. a week. I know from my days covering the Obama White House that the Obama-Biden lunches were one-on-one. They were sacred space. The two of them never talked about anything that was discussed there almost ever to mm-hmm. anyone else. And they would hash things out. Mm-hmm. That's the most information mm-hmm. you would get out of it. They really yeah. talked about things, frankly. Trump and Pence have lunch regularly, but what you have in your book is that they don't do it one-on-one, that they actually bring John Kelly, the White House mm-hmm. chief staff, Trump's chief staff, and Nick Ayers, mm-hmm. Pence's chief staff, are there to guide the conversation.
It was strange to me to hear that. And again, it wasn't said with any sense of embarrassment or trying to cover it up. But to me, it speaks volumes about their relationship because, like you said, you know, Biden really treasured that time. Al Gore mm-hmm. told me that was the most important. It was so important to Al Gore that if there was a missed lunch because Clinton was traveling, he would insist that they meet at 9 o'clock at night alone, you know, or just make it happen once a week. And so the fact that John Kelly and Nick Ayers are sitting taking notes so that Nick Ayers, you know, told me to so that he could answer questions. Mm-hmm. For Pence, if he had any after the lunch, and that Trump is generally scattered, and so they steer and focus the conversation. I don't know, you know, what other reason there would be for that. I mean, you can just consider if anything comes up with the Russia investigation mm-hmm. or any of the scandals swirling around the White House, it's good to have two other people there who can be witnesses to whatever they're discussing. I wasn't told that. I'm just thinking mm-hmm. it's only logical that there is some reason for this because it is really abnormal.
Vox has a new daily podcast you should add to your routine. It's called Today Explained. Every afternoon, Vox's team of public radio expats puts together a 20-minute look at an essential news story. It's always rich in production and fun to listen to. Imagine a running list of all the Mueller indictments set to Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire, or an explainer on the history of kneeling in pro sports, or why Saudi Arabian women finally getting the right to drive isn't as progressive as it seems. And then subscribe to Today Explained wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to talk about the Joe Biden relationship a little bit, but I'll start with that. There's a moment in your book that I personally found interesting because it relates to something that I reported on back in 2015, which is when Joe Biden was thinking about running for president. Mm-hmm. There was a Maureen Dowd column in the New York Times that had this sort of deathbed scene of Joe Biden talking to – or of Beau Biden mm-hmm. talking to Joe Biden saying, you've got to run. You're the only one that can stop the Clintons. That made a huge impact when it ran. And October of 2015, about 2 weeks before Biden dropped out, I reported at the time that Biden had been the one to talk to Maureen Dowd about it. And
I remember your story. Yes.
And there were some denials issued at the time that that wasn't true. But and I should say that in Joe Biden's book, he writes about that as what he thought was the low point in the campaign for him, or in the proto campaign, talks about my article over the course of a page. And he says the Politico story exceeded even my worst expectations of what the opposition was going to be like. But here's the thing about it. It's true that he talked to Maureen Dowd. The way you put it is that an aide orchestrated this call.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was told also, exactly what you were told. And that then maybe he, you know, in retrospect, shouldn't have done it. And he was kind of getting through his grief. And I was told he was in kind of a fog and wanted to test the waters. He had so much pressure.
I mean, he was in a very emotional state then. That is for sure true. But what do you make of the fact that that happened, that the denials happened after that? What does that tell us about Joe Biden?
I think Joe Biden really obviously wants to be president and still very much wants to be president. But the reality of his life, reality of his family situation now and then, and, you know, Beau was there, you know, he was just so in love with his son, and you can't imagine what that would be like. I had his speechwriter and others told me that he would get so excited when Beau was on TV that he would like call everyone over to look at it, and he would brag about him all the time. And it was just this really close father-son relationship. And I do think there is just so much emotion there. But then also there's this big ego, right? Another aide told me, like, he, you know, he measures his worth on the inches in the newspaper, you know, that he never wants to be seen as on his way down. A lot of politicians are like that. I mean, it's depressing, right?
And look, I mean, did you ever meet Beau Biden?
Yes.
He, there was something where you could see like, okay, maybe that guy is going to be president. Yeah. And he had, he sounded just like Joe Biden. They had almost the same voice, certainly the same intonations, a little bit less gravelly. He looked like Joe Biden, but he was more measured. It was sort of like there, in some ways, it felt like if Obama and Biden had had a son, he would have been Beau Biden, right? And Obama at Beau Biden's funeral called him Biden 2.0. There was this sense that Joe Biden seemed to have at some point in the Obama presidency, like, okay, well, maybe I'm not going to be president, but the way that things will work is that Beau is meant to be that person. And one of his people, one of Joe Biden's people said to me last year about the 2020 stuff, he's a great believer in fate. And that is certainly true about Joe Biden, right? So he that he had believed that maybe the fate was that Beau Biden would be the president now that he died, that if maybe things are directing him to be president.
I mean, he'll be 78, right? I think that's the age.
He would turn 78 a week and a half after Election Day 2020.
So I interviewed him at his office, you know, which is downtown in D.C. And we walked out to the elevator bank after we talked. And there was an office next door and people crowded around to meet him. And his face just lit. He was, you know, he feeds off of that in a way
I don't think that there is a more extroverted person who's ever been born.
Maybe Bill Clinton.
I
you don't think so?
Yeah. I mean, there was the famously when Beau Biden died at his wake, it was 11 or 12 hours. Joe Biden stood receiving people and stood there for 12 hours. That's a long time for anybody to stand there. And he was drawing strength from it is what people were seeing. And you could see with your eyes in it that he really was feeding off of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the only thing that would keep him from running would be just, you know, still the grief, still the family situation, right? You know, what's happened since Beau's death is kind of messy personally for him. But, you know, if he could pick a vice president who was a lot younger, you know, there's been talk of the one term thing. I never got that from anybody on the record or anything like that. But I'm sure you've heard that.
I reported that, actually.
Oh, okay. So
there's the thought of like finding a young vice president or jumping in early or jumping in late or saying that he'd run for one term. What I've been told about the one term thing is that Joe Biden himself is not into that because, to your point, he doesn't want to be seen as somebody whose story is being written off from the moment that it starts, right? So, if you say I'm going to do a one-term presidency, then the minute that you win the election, the only question is, okay, who's running in 4 years, right?
That's right. And his ego is very, I mean, he's a lovable guy. What you see is what you get, as you know, with him. I mean, he really is that guy. He was funny. He took my hand, and this was at the height of the Me Too movement, and he took me over to a photo on the wall, and he said, is it okay if I take your hand? Is this okay? Because he's very touchy-feely.
He is.
Which, you know.
With men and women, but.
Yeah. I mean, with of any age, yes. You know, it's not really creepy with him at all. It doesn't seem that way. But like, he's just a very kind of old school folksy politician. I always thought his relationship with the Clintons was really interesting because, you know, you hear all different things about how close he was to them and the jealousy. You know, there's got to be some jealousy there because they're so much alike. It kind of reminds me of Ron Klain, who was Biden's chief of staff, you know.
And was also Gore's chief of staff.
Yeah.
Right?
And he described how, you know, Al Gore looked at Bill Clinton and thought, if I could just be a little bit like folksier and like easygoing, I could be him. I could be Bill Clinton. Well, Joe Biden never looked at Barack Obama and said, I could be him, because Barack Obama was like this sensation.
Right. There's the famous moment, and you have it in your book too, where he says to David Axelrod, I thought that I could that I was better than him, or that I could be president. Like, this worked out the right way.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
But does he have, did you find any remorse within him, any spite, anything left over from Obama's decision to steer the Democratic nomination very clearly to Hillary Clinton and steer him out of the race?
I mean, nothing on the record, obviously, but yes, I think he seemed, you know, he said, of course, he regrets not being president, and he said that publicly. And I think that by the timing of it was just so terrible because there was just no way.
Right. Beau died in Memorial Day of 2015. And obviously, that was right at the moment where he would have had to be gone with the presidential campaign.
And I think, you know, the only thing I found with him, and I have this in the book, is the Navy SEAL raid, the Bin Laden raid. There was, and among his staff, too, resentment and anger towards Hillary Clinton for taking so much credit for being supportive of the raid. And they said, you know, actually, she really wasn't. And Biden, you know, said, listen, I fell on my sword and admitted that I wasn't 100% for it. And then he later said
the day before he said he wasn't running in 2015, he had this weird moment. I was there. He was at an event with Walter Mondale talking about vice presidents.
Yes. I've watched that.
And he said, actually, I went back to the Oval Office after the meeting and told Obama to do it.
Yes.
And then it became this weird thing where he had been saying all through the 2012 campaign, you know, I didn't think there was the right call to make, but Obama, Barack knew what to do. And that was part of his argument for Obama being reelected. But then when it was time for him to maybe think about running for president, and he was in the final throes of it, he changed it. And, I was told that day by the vice president's staff that actually the version of the story where he goes back to the Oval Office and doesn't say in front of everybody else, you should do it, is the accurate one. It's the fuller story because, yes, in the room he was resistant to it because he didn't want to seem like he was putting his thumb on the scale. But he wanted to tell Obama in private that, so that the version that he'd been telling publicly was only the first half of the story. But it is, I think within that you see the trickiness of vice presidents relating to presidents, especially as it comes to their own political futures, right?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. You don't want to look like you have no record.
Right.
I mean, you know, it goes back to Eisenhower in 1960 being asked about Nixon,
right,
you know, and what were his accomplishments? And he said to the reporter, I'll get back to you. And he never did. So that's Mike Pence's challenge now, is he has not been able to take credit for tax reform. I mean, anything he's done, he doesn't take credit for it. And I mean, how is he going to – he clearly wants to run in 2024.
You think he clearly does?
Yes. Absolutely. I've been told that he does. I mean, by people who work for him. And everything he's done is a sign of that. One thing I think is interesting, too, is that his brother Greg told me – and this
Greg, who's running for Congress himself.
Yes.
Right?
When his seat is going to be the Republican and I think looks
he's
exactly
in good shape
like
to be a member of Congress.
Yes. He said, you know, that he won't talk to me now. So I got him right before, thankfully. He said, you know, Mike was when Trump asked him to be his running mate, Pence called his brother and said, you know, he reminds me of our father. Mm-hmm. And Greg Pence was sort of taken aback by that and said, you know, it makes sense. Our father was like tough and told you what he thought. And it's been reported that the father was also kind of abusive and would hit the kids with belts and was really strict disciplinarian. Six kids in that family, if an adult walked in the room, they would force them to their feet. So the idea that Trump reminds Pence of their kind of bullying father to me is really interesting mm-hmm. because he's 13 years older than Pence. Mm-hmm. Pence, you know, you saw the
Trump water. Is 13 years yes. older than Pence, yes.
And you saw the water bottle mm-hmm. incident. Mm-hmm. There's many examples.
They're sitting at a briefing. It was a hurricane briefing, I think.
Yeah.
And Trump takes his bottle of water off the table and then Pence in like the exact same movement does. And what's not clear is what exactly was driving that, whether they were clearing the space for pictures.
But
or
nobody else,
whether,
everyone else right, still had their bottles on the
but
table.
But Pence did the exact same thing that Trump did.
It's just a little odd, you know. There seems to be, I think Biden's, the advantage Biden and Obama had is, you know, Biden was a lot older, had a lot more experience, 4 decades almost in Congress, mm-hmm. in the Senate. And I just think that there was deference there. That Obama mm-hmm. had towards the end, especially. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the only president and vice president who grew closer over those 8 years. I was surprised how hard it was at the beginning because I never sensed that. Maybe mm-hmm. you did. But I never thought – I always kind of bought the idea that it was love at first sight for Biden and Obama. And it wasn't. It was tricky. It was annoying to Biden to have to ask permission for things mm-hmm. like who his Senate replacement would be and, you know – and how like insulting it was for Joe Biden and Chris Dodd to be carrying their own luggage in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And then Obama's like this huge mm-hmm. hit who just came out of nowhere. And what's that like?
Right.
So it's more complicated. I think it's.
But by the end, it was like actual love.
Yeah.
And they do have this weirdly deep emotional relationship. And weirdly only because it's not something that two people who work together in those roles develop.
No, I think it's very sweet. I mean, you know, Biden told me that he stopped talking about Beau so much when he was sick at those lunches mm-hmm. because Obama would get so emotional. Mm-hmm. And that says a lot because that's a real friendship, you mm-hmm. know. And then there's a story about the mortgage that mm-hmm. – and I asked Biden because
Gloria – the story is that Biden was – they were worried about paying the medical bills yeah. and he was going to take a second mortgage. And Obama said, I'll give you the money. Don't do
yeah.
that.
And right. And it was a CNN interview where he said that. And I asked him when I went back and interviewed him if he did have to take that more. He said he didn't. Mm-hmm. But like the fact that Obama would be willing to do that, mm-hmm. That's very personal mm-hmm. and touching. And I think, you know, Obama like joked with Biden about how could you have no money when he was first looking at him as his VP? Like, you have no money. How is right. this possible?
And Biden likes to brag about that, that he was the poorest member of the Senate. That is a standard Joe Biden line you will hear in 9 out of 10 Joe Biden appearances.
Probably 10 out of 10.
He'll say they like to call me middle class Joe.
Yeah.
They meant it as an insult, but I didn't take it as an insult. Those are the Biden lines.
There are so many. And his speechwriter told me, and you might have heard this, that it's because of his stutter. Mm-hmm. That he repeats a lot of the same things still. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a musician.
Yeah. He used to have this terrible stutter as a kid.
Yeah.
They called him Dash. That was his nickname because he would dash, trying to get words out. So, look, you said you think Pence wants to run for president in 2024. But I want you to imagine a situation where it's possible. I don't think we have any reason to believe it's likely at this point. But that if President Trump is not running for reelection and Pence decides to run in 2020 and Joe Biden runs in 2020, let's end it on this. What does that race look like? Two vice presidents running against each other, two guys who, as you report in your book, have had some conversations with each other about the job, have certainly more of a relationship than Barack Obama and Donald Trump do, who have not spoken since Obama got on the helicopter at the end of the inauguration. And I don't think either of them is upset about that. But but Biden and Pence do have a relationship. Mm-hmm. What would it look like for the two of them to run against each other, you think?
We saw a little taste of it when Biden said, you know, if I was running against Donald Trump, I'd take him in the back of the woodshed or whatever his thing was. And it was kind of, I think it was not well received. It was sinking down to that level. I think any Democrat would be wise to not mention Donald Trump very much. I think Biden has to, you know, when I talked to him, he was very clear. He said, I don't agree with anything pretty much that Mike Pence thinks or does. But like Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, I can work with him. I can talk to him. They talk at least once a month. I think that race would be, you know, two completely different people. It would be fascinating to watch. I mean, it would be, I would have to wonder, I think that one of them would absolutely need a woman running with them. Or
do you think that they would bash each other?
Well, you know, Mike Pence did bash Phil Sharpe in 1990 and he can, you know, wrote this op-ed about
when he was running for Congress.
Yeah. And I interviewed Phil Sharpe and, and Sharpe said, I never got an apology personally from Mike Pence. But I think that, you know, it's a great question because I don't know if Mike Pence would get in the mud. I think he might. I think it might get really nasty.
Do you think it would be a Trump-Obama proxy war?
Yes, absolutely. And I think Mike Pence has been very smart to keep the conservative evangelicals. I don't think that it's been seen as hypocritical or a betrayal, even though a lot of what Trump stands for, as you said, the travel ban that, that Mike Pence personally came out and criticized, a lot of his personal issues are, you know, clearly there will be charges of hypocrisy. And there are. I just think the noise of what's happening now is that people can't focus on Mike Pence. And I think once they do, if he runs for president, they will see there are a lot of things that are clearly just blatant ambition, unbridled ambition. And that's all politicians. But with Mike Pence, the problem is it's cloaked in this virtuous, you know, Christianity. And if you're really Christian, some of what he does is obviously antithetical. It's not anything that the Bible would stand for. And I, it's just very difficult now talking about politics because it's just so different than it was when I wrote my other two books, when you could be nonpartisan and talk about it. But now if you just state the facts, it makes you seem like you're being
right.
But you deal with this every day. I just
I do. And it's a tricky thing. But yeah, facts don't have an agenda. They're just facts. And they can be tricky. They can be uncomfortable. That is what we are finding a lot of. But there are a lot of facts in your book. It was worth reading to get up to speed, not just with these two vice presidential relationships we talked about, but with the span going back through the last, what's the number, seven?
Seven. Right.
So there's a lot in there.
Actually, I start with Nixon and Eisenhower.
Right.
So I go way back, if anyone's interested. Walter Mondale, really amazing guy.
Yep.
He started the modern vice presidency. And every vice president, even Mike Pence, would agree with that. So I think Mike Pence is a little more willing, clearly much more willing to reach back than Donald Trump is. So that's a good thing.
All right. Kate Anderson Brown, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Isaac.
So what do you think? What does that tell you about Donald Trump? What does it tell you about Barack Obama? And of course, what does it tell you about Mike Pence and Joe Biden? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. Thanks, as always, to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe and spread the word. And of course, follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dobert so you don't miss anything about upcoming episodes or other articles I'm working on. And catch you next time on Off Message.